CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 144 with Dr. Rehan Ahmed, how artificial intelligence is changing ophthalmology and what you need to do to be involved. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I have a very special guest and a very special topic. And the topic is all about AI in ophthalmology, artificial intelligence. What do you need to know? What will be coming down the road? And how do we prepare for it? And for that, I have a man who has his own podcast about AI, Dr. Rehan Ahmed. Welcome to my podcast, my friend.
Thank you for having me today. This is a great treat, a great honor. I am a longtime fan, longtime listener. I think I'm probably in the top, one of the first few Cataract Coach podcast subscribers back in 2018. So I think you're doing great stuff, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, we first actually met probably 15 plus years ago, right? When you were a resident.
That's right. That's right. You did a grand rounds at Baylor. Well, I did my residency at Baylor in Houston. And we had hundreds of grand rounds over the course of, you know, three years. I could say for my class, we distinctly remember yours as being one of the best. And it was because you brought so much energy, and you talked about your passion was obviously infectious. We were all super excited about ophthalmology afterwards, like having lunch afterwards, like, this is amazing. Because like, you gave us a lesson. I still remember. It's like, you know what? Orthopedists do spine. Neurosurgeons do spine. Other people do spine. And there's so much, there's like competition. There's like other things, and you have to deal with that. You know who only does ophthalmology and eye surgery? Ophthalmologists. You know, it is our domain, and I just loved it. Your dedication to excellence. I love that grand rounds, and I really appreciate it. You did the grand rounds. I remember this. And then you spent an extra hour with the residents. It wasn't scheduled. It wasn't planned. And you said, hey, let's just chat about careers.
Right.
And it was great. Thank you so much for that. That was great.
Oh, you're so welcome. I mean, that's the goal, is to have some kind of impact and obviously to spread this incredible enthusiasm, because, yeah, I'm thankful every day that I'm an ophthalmologist. How did I get this lucky in my life? I mean, it's amazing. The only time where I think, okay, wait a minute, is when I'm on an airplane and I travel a lot, and they're like, is there a doctor on board? And I just think to myself, what do you want me to do, check the pupils?
That's right. I don't know, you're just a Dr. Glaucum Flecken, his comedy stuff, and he has a good video on that about the one of the greatest fear for ophthalmologists is being called on an emergency on a plane. So yeah, I kind of slouched down in my chair too. So, but I won't tell anyone that.
Tell me more about your kind of career path. So you practiced there in the Dallas, greater Dallas area.
Yes.
And what did you do after residency? Because you did a few things that are unusual.
Yeah, you know, I will say, so I was a big nerd in high school. Like, it was 1999, it was year Y2K, and I was graduating from high school that year. But I was on a computer programming artificial neural networks. I was taking a class at a local university on the mind-body problem. And I was working on a project getting a robot eyes, vision. And it had a mechanical arm playing tic-tac-toe, and my responsibility was programming the neural network to identify X's and O's. Okay. And that got me just interested in artificial intelligence. It got me interested in the eye and ophthalmology, and therefore I went to med school. But I tell my mom, because, you know, I'm also a Desi background, and she's like, you have to go to medical school. So I'm a good son, so I went to, but I was like, no, what if I had done AI back then? You know, it would have been a totally different career, because I was interested in it. That got me interested in ophthalmology, and then did residency, got into private practice, and I've just been so curious about this stuff for such a long time, like you, that when it started coming out, I thought, this is going to be the most impactful, way more than the internet, most impactful new technology we're going to face with. I just wanted to get into it as deeply as I could.
So, well, very precocious, the 1999, 26 years ago. That's so true. It kind of corresponds with, you know, my co-resident and I, John Lattice, who was a co-resident. Yes. We were residents from 97 or 2000. And in 97 is when IBM's Deep Blue beat Kasparov at chess. And we were just like, whoa.
Yeah.
And that's kind of at that point too, maybe a year or two later, we're about the same time as you. And I started thinking more about, like, how do you incorporate this into what we're doing?
Yeah.
And then we got an interest in, like, okay, we had an interest in IOL Calc. It's like our website, IOLCalc.com. If you look up the URL, I registered that URL July 1 of 2000, 26 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 25 years ago. So it's just like, it's crazy.
Yeah. And now it's kind of like everyone's like, of course you'd use AI for this. But back then, it was, I mean, that wasn't even on the map, right?
Even 10 years ago, it was not obvious at all.
It was not obvious. It was not obvious. And I remember I went to med school at Vanderbilt, and I remember doing a project in diabetic retinopathy screening saying, you know, we looked at that. And it was, the technology was just not mature at that point to do autonomous or automated analyses of fundus photographs. But there's been so much technology upgrades in the past 26 years that, you know, it's amazing what one person can do now. I mean, they're talking about the solo entrepreneur who's starting a $1 billion company. And this is possible. I mean, there's so many tools at our disposal. And so, you know, my Clarion, the thing I'm really preaching now to every ophthalmologist, I mean, it's like, you just got to get into this stuff. And I've seen a lot of trepidation, but I think it's just, it's fantastic. And I know you use a ton of tools, and I'm excited to talk about that.
Right. And they just keep evolving. I mean, the number of tools available you have for free.
For free.
Well, I'm okay. You give them your data and they track everything about you.
That's right. You told me, I think there's a lot of parallels with ophthalmology because we are a kind of a tech forward specialty, right? Mm. We're lasers, IOL calculations, new types of lenses. When I talk to my primary care buddies, I'm like, what's your new? And it's like, oh, like, I'm kind of, it's, again, it's an amazing thing about ophthalmology. We just get so many, we're kind of spoiled. I mean, don't you think about how many tools and gadgets we get to use? It's like, I mean, and you're working, I mean, we haven't talked about Horizon and the robotic stuff, but it's just fantastic. I think that gives us a leg up in being early adopters of technology. We're just so curious. I mean, I think maybe it's a selection bias. We're curious about all that stuff.
Huge selection bias. So it's like, we're all geeks. Every ophthalmologist is an absolute total geek, right? So it's funny how we can pretend now to be cool, but let's be straight. I was a total geek in high school. I was a nerd in college, and I was a dork in med school. I mean, come on, of course. It's funny. When I had residents, I would query them like, so Rehan, you and I were both high school valedictorian. Of course we were. But it was like 50% of my residents were high school valedictorian, 50. And this is back in the day when there was one out of a class of like 500, 600, 700, not like now where they're like 12 of them or 15 of them. Yeah. So it's like, it's complete selection bias, but yeah, we're total geeks and nerds and we love this stuff and I embrace it. And I look at the world a mathematical way off very often. And now it's just so natural to go into the AI stuff. It's the next step.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing with ophthalmology where we have an advantage, I mean, this is where the IO calls, is the amount of data we have. And it's not just textual data or numerical data, which is what my calcs are, but there's so much imaging data, and that is so rich with potentially developing data sets. So we're like a primary care type of specialty. So we just get it on our patients. We don't have to call a radiologist, you know, we just get an OCT, get a topography, do fundus photography. And so we have access to so much data and therefore so many tools that we could use to help patients.
Right. I mean, it's gotten to the point where certain things are certainly better than humans. Like the example I give an IOL calculations is that, yeah, a human, I can optimize a single A constant for an IOL. But that doesn't make any sense because how would you treat a 28 diopter hyperopic small eye the same as a 10 diopter very large myopic? You cannot. But, you know, we can use an AI version to calculate, all right, instead of optimizing just one A constant, we can do 10 ranges of axial length, 10 ranges of AC depth, 10 ranges of K values. Well, that's a 10 by 10 by 10 or 1,000 point matrix. I can optimize 1,000 points in space instead of just one A constant. Yeah. And then the other thing, now if you go to imaging, you said, crazy part is, you know, I can look at a fundus photo and say, this is probably a young person, like 20-ish years old. This is probably an 80-year-old. Well, you have a year or two, which is crazy. And AI now could look at a retina image and tell you, is this a male or female? And I have no idea how to do that.
Definitely.
It was crazy.
It's absolutely, and that's a whole field of oculomics, right? So oculomics, for your listeners who may not, and I'm sure most of your listeners know, it's the field of ophthalmology or of eye care, where you're looking at, it doesn't have to be a fundus photograph. It could be other things. But typically it's a retina photograph and you're diagnosing other non-extraocular issues like cardiac disease or neurologic disease. And it really started based off, you know, late 2015's lab in Google that started doing the sex prediction based on a fundus photograph. We still have no idea how it actually figures it out. And some people are like, well, maybe it's the diameter of the vessels. Maybe it's some type of the pigment in the background. But we're like, I still have no idea, you know. But a computer with 99% accuracy figures it out. It could talk about cardiac prediction, you know, Alzheimer's prediction, kidney disease. So think about all the things you can now do with a retinal photograph. And it's just fantastic. So that's, and you know, we sort of like when people talk about oculum, I'm like, you know, in med school, they talked about the eye as a sentinel of the disease. And, you know, that's probably like, there's so many health things that you could do with the eye, but we're talking about superhero type abilities.
Right. I mean, it's just, it is really mind blowing. But I mean, the amount of advancement we've had, even in just the last 5-10 years, is just going to be just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I sort of think about AI in sort of three buckets generally. When I go around talking, I've had sort of the benefit of doing multiple talks, but like just to sort of like build a framework because things get so complicated. There's like AI as an assistant, right? And this is where I think is like kind of like the low hanging fruit where a lot of people, I think this is where, if you're an ophthalmologist in private practice or in academics, this is where there's a lot of tools out that can help you. Scheduling assistants, scribing assistants, really sort of helpful things. Like imagine your best scribe just having an AI version of that. Then there's AI as an agent. And this is doing your stuff that, you know, you can, you do, but it's offloading that. Like diabetic retinopathy screening, right? I think that makes a ton of sense. I mean, you don't, there's a burden of disease out there. We don't have enough ophthalmologists, even eye care providers, optometrists to look at all the retina photographs that we need to do.
Right.
Then there's AI as the superhuman. And this is AI that we can't do what it's doing. And this is exactly what I was talking about, the oculomic stuff, the cardiac prediction, the neurodegenerative prediction. And especially as we get therapies to hopefully make a dent in Alzheimer's, imagine going to an eye care provider in your 60s and 70s and getting maybe an early diagnosis. And then hopefully there's something you could actually do about it. So that's where I see sort of the three buckets of AI as it pertains to eye care. And I think that's been very helpful for me in sort of evaluating new technologies as they come in. Like which bucket am I putting this in?
Right. And that's, I think the amount of advance we're going to see in the next few years is going to just keep increasing very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the next point of doing these superhuman things, I mean, like we're using this AI now in certain parts of, say, the robotic company.
Yeah.
And some of the predictive things are like, wow, just didn't see that coming. And I think the next part too, even switching gears to the robots, is right now we use the robots to kind of emulate the way a human would do the surgery. But what if you didn't have those restrictions? Like, what if I could just have like, okay, I'm used to making incisions here because that's
where
my
right? Yeah.
What if I can just do it anywhere? What if you don't need to do just, you know, these same techniques we're doing now? What if we make a tiny opening in the lens capsule, we have a little propeller blade that emulsifies the whole nucleus, you suck it out like a milkshake, and maybe that's different. Maybe you fill the capsule bag with a gel polymer instead of, you know, these acrylic IOLs. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's where creativity comes into play, and it starts coming up at novel type of solutions. And that's the deep blue example you gave. If you listen to interviews from Garry Kasparov, he found the computer to be, it wasn't doing classical chess techniques. I'm kind of like a chess nerd, but he wasn't doing classical chess techniques. It got him because it was orthogonal to normal chess. Like it was unusual. It was creative. And the way he described it is like talking about a gifted surgeon doing things in a way that he couldn't figure out what was going on. But it was just, it was plotting out so many moves in advance. And so can you imagine, maybe there's a more efficient way to do it, or there's a better way to do it that we haven't considered. Certainly there are probably.
Right. I think the neat part here, there's some fear that among ophthalmologists, whether it's AI stuff or robotic stuff, that you're going to be replaced. Yeah. I think it's an unfounded fear. I understand why you'd feel that way, but I don't see that happening at all. I think it's just going to certainly just augment you. If you look back a generation or two, you think back, okay, the genius of the macula, the godfather of the macula is Don Gass. So when you look at the Gass atlases that he made like 20, 30 years ago, he drew pictures that look like OCT scans because he had this crazy ability to look with a 78 Doppler lens at a macula, and he had the OCT built in his brain. And I would always see his images, and then I'd see the patient in my clinic, and I'm like, I don't see that.
Right.
So then we got an OCT machine. It made me like, wow, now I have diagnostic skills equivalent to Don Gass.
That's right.
But now the next step is, How about treatment algorithms? There are some people who have incredibly bright treatment. Let's look at glaucoma. Well, no, we should start you with this, then move to this. And if you have this much progression, then you should do this. There are genius glaucoma experts who have these algorithms just in their brains, in their back of their mind, in their hearts. And they just know, well, I don't have that. But now with this AI thing, I can have the same treatment algorithm.
Yeah.
Analyze the same scans. And I can have that person's brain.
Yeah. You know, there's this kind of like maybe overused buzzword of a AI is a democratization tool. And it does sort of do that. It democratizes the expertise. Like imagine a robotic surgeon that was trained off Uday Devgan. Like you could bring that level of surgical expertise to patients around the world, or diagnostic abilities for glaucoma or retina disease. And, you know, I think that the holy grail is giving the absolute best care to every single patient. Because as you both know, you know, we're all different. We all have strengths and weaknesses. Some, you know, some are very good at certain things and some are not as good at certain things, be it diagnostic stuff or surgical stuff. But why can't we elevate everyone to bring excellence to every single patient encounter?
I say this stuff will make the rest of us as good as the best of us. Look catchy.
Yeah. You should trademark that too. That's good. That's a good one.
Right. It'll just increase the bar for everyone, make everyone be better for sure. Everyone now with an OCT machine, you have the diagnostic ability of the world's best macular specialist, Don Gass. Yeah. In your hands.
Exactly. And now everyone has it, doesn't think anything of it.
Right.
So I think that's a fantastic use case. And when I talk to ophthalmologists, they're worried about being replaced. I think that's a concern. I think it's totally unfounded, especially when there's so many the great thing about ophthalmology, again, another great thing, is that we just see so many problems in clinic, from efficient, just like basic stuff, like surgical coordination or efficiencies in flow of clinic. If you're in a busy clinic, it's really, it can be very frustrating sometimes. And there's so many AI tools that are out there that can, you know, it hasn't all come to fruition, but it's coming, and we could sort of see the writing on the wall that it will definitely help our flow.
Right. I think the low hanging fruit is, I need to start incorporating like a scribe in my clinic, an AI scribe which is ophthalmology trained. So right. He understands, you know, our buzzword, pseudo exfoliation, doesn't come up as like a question mark. It just understands what that means. So I think that's step one. I think another one is with patient interactions. I mean, how much time do you spend fielding phone calls for patients or relatively simple things? Where you could have an AI agent kind of go through the tree with you. And so
So in my clinic, we're using a couple of tools. Some of them are third party. Some of them we've developed ourselves. One is a tool that does pre-authorizations for every single patient. It's an AI voice bot that will call the insurance companies to get a verification of benefits before they come in.
Wow.
You can, you know, dealing with insurance is a big pain point. And we have a staff, you know, there's a big staff to like deal with that. You're paying them. And they get, not that you'd actually replace them. And that's what they're all, everyone's sort of being worried about being replaced. But then you could have them do higher levels of things because the AI is not going to do everything. It will actually triage to you when the AI voice bot gets, you know, gets hung up. But it will call the insurance company and say, and at the end, it's great. It says, so, you know, Miss So-and-so, how did you like speaking with me today? And it's, you know, most of them like, it was fine, you know, but it's great. It's a fantastic tool, improves our efficiency, increases our reimbursement rates. And so that's a great tool that we're using.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're going to have more and more of these. Also, you can develop apps now with AI. It's just so easy to do any of this stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
The problem is I don't have enough hours in the week to play with all this stuff. Like I was playing with Nano Banana, which is Google's AI
image. Yeah, I know exactly.
I spent hours like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm having too much fun.
It's there's so many fun tools. I encourage it way beyond ChatGPT. I think Nano Banana is a good one. You know, there's a lot of great image development stuff where you could like type in a prompt and it just makes a beautiful image. I mean, you could use that for your own clinic to like make advertisements, make videos. You know, we developed a couple tools in the house for voice bots to help our surgical coordinator. You know, I was just talking to her and I said, you know, how much time do you spend like dealing with phone calls that truthfully, if the patient or the family read the preoperative stuff, like, you know, the drops after, because they'll call and say, oh, when should I start my Vigamox? Oh, when should I do this? And And it's like, well, it's on the paperwork. But why not have a voice bot free up our surgical coordinator so we're not dealing with those types of phone calls? And the funny thing, patients love it because they could call anytime and our voice bot surgical coordinator never gets tired of talking to them.
Right. I mean, another one I want to kind of incorporate is, you know, the text messages.
Yeah.
So you do the patient surgery and then, like, you know, a few hours later, text the patient, okay, at this point, you should be experiencing this. Let me know if anything is unusual. And, like, even, you know, just follow-ups.
Yeah. And I'm surprised. I won't say shocked, but I do surveys. I've done surveys every year to about 300 ophthalmologists where I say, you know, are you using AI tools and what are you using? And, you know, unfortunately, it's 80% or plus have not really used anything in their clinical environment. And I even say most of them don't even use ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or whatever on a routine basis. I mean, and for me, I use that stuff every day. I drive, when I'm driving to work, I sometimes instead of the radio, I'll have ChatGPT and I'm just talking to it with various ideas I have and it's talking back to me. So I'm just like, how are you not using it? You gotta start using it.
Right. And it's certainly getting better and better. Now I've often used, you know, one of these LLMs like ChatGPT to help me write an article. But I always have to go back and reread it because it's not quite there. It's just not quite there.
Yeah. It's getting better. I mean, don't you think it's getting better though? I mean, I find that it's not quite there. But the prompting makes such an importance. And the more you use it, the more you upload from the documents you've written in the past, it can really match your tone in a way that's pretty darn good. It's not going to be perfect, and that's where your expertise comes in, and that's where humans will always sort of be needed. But I will say I'm getting increasing. Every new generation, I'm like, oh wow, ChatGPT 5.1. It is. I see it. It is getting pretty good.
It's getting right. Like in the earlier ones, we're kind of easily fooled. Really easily fooled.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But now it's. I think it's a lot better. I mean, I remember when we first had access to ChatGPT. I saw some examples where I tried. Some were like, how many states have the letter R in their names? And it'd make up some random number. And I was like, wait, and it'd list them. And they'd list them and it'd be like Iowa, Texas. I'm like, wait a minute, those are wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, my apologies, is correct. Oh, you're correct. Okay, we'll fix that.
Yeah, so yeah. No, I mean, you definitely have to do some basic QA on this. But I've been, it's just, I'm increasingly impressed with how much better and how much faster it's getting in responding. And, you know, maybe I'm sort of biased, but yeah, I mean, so long as you do some basic QA on it, I think you should be fine. I do say, like, when I read other people's posts or papers, I'm like, you used ChatGPT, didn't you? And so I think now the weird thing is, like, we're entering this world where if someone has a typo in their email, I'm like, oh, wow, this is actually like, they actually wrote it themselves. They didn't use ChatGPT. Like, I love it. There's like a sense of humanity in there because there's like errors in there and, you know, it's not exactly formatted right, et cetera. And so now, you know, if I send out an email, maybe I'll put like an extra period in there just to like make a little error so people will know that, you know, there was some human oversight or some human involved in the process. Because imperfection, you know, is a type of beauty in itself.
Right, yeah, for sure. Wabi-sabi, right? Japanese concept of beauty of imperfection.
That's right. Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's good.
So, no, I think that's certainly important. The problem is, I think I sent an email now. I'm just wondering, Google already just summarized it for me in the AI. I'm like, do I even read the whole email? There's another question. Now, the other problem I think we're going to get to is someone estimated at this point all new content on the internet, like a large percentage of it, maybe even approaching half, is AI generated.
Yeah.
Well, then don't we get to the point then where it's just AI training itself on its own product?
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to train the AI on our human created content, not to just train it on itself over and over again. But now we're getting to that point where maybe it's getting trained on stuff that's just not right, that it created itself.
Yeah, and it turns into this vicious cycle where it's just spewing out more AI-based content that's trained on itself and who knows what. So I think human ingenuity, human creativity is always going to play a role, right? You're going to always have to have that to train these models. People call it, I think it's not like a dead internet theory, but most of the traffic online is actually bots. It's not actually even humans. It's like 80% bots trolling around. And so, yeah, I think this is a real problem. I don't know if anyone has the answer yet. And so I think, you know, what are like, and so I have young kids. And so sometimes I feel like, what, I talk to my wife about this all the time. Like, what skills should we be teaching our kids in school and beyond to be living in this AI world, right? Because, you know, we're kind of blessed in the sense that, like, we're in this transition period where I think we're going to be fine because they're going to need us. But they may live in a world where who knows, right? And so I think one of the things I like doing is I think daydreaming is going to be the creativity. New
yeah.
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Creativity. And specifically connecting unrelated, totally unrelated things. Think like Newton sitting under a tree and an apple hitting his head coming up with gravity, right? Like AI could never do that because it's so unrelated. It doesn't make any sense. But that's what I think we should be talking to our kids about and really having, like, I think the best thing is just to do nothing sometimes and just let your mind wander in ways so you can make these connections. I don't know. Am I like smoking something?
That's a fantastic idea. Because if you think back, and I'm about a decade older than you. When I was in school, they made us learn how to write in cursive. Because that was the you got. Because back in the old days of a quill, you didn't want to lift your pen. You wanted to write the whole word without lifting your pen. Yeah. That's cursive. Okay. Well, now my kids really didn't learn cursive in school. It's useless. It's no point. Well, then similarly, like, you know, we spent how much time learning how to do long division.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, you don't really have to do that anymore. It's great if you understand the concept of it, but the concept is probably more important than the execution.
Right.
So just like, and I had the very strict parents growing up where I had to like memorize my timetables up to 20. So I still know them up to 20.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. Bananas.
Because, you know, 16 times 19, you never know. There may be like, you know, you have to know that getting an answer within 5 seconds. See, I'm glad you know that. So
right. So, but I think, yeah, we have to change the way we're doing things. Now, those kind of skills are just not that useful. Yeah. Right. Stop learning cursive. And then even this, the things that you could delegate for a computer to do, we should probably delegate.
Yeah.
But the nice part is, yeah, you can now start an entire company just in your head.
Yeah.
So it's a different world for sure.
Yeah. And it has its own set of challenges, right? Like, I think for highly creative types, stuff like ChatGPT is like a godsend because I literally stay up at night. I'm just like coming up with ideas after ideas, asking it to evaluate it. And, so that's what I try to encourage with my kids. Just, you know, if you have ideas, like, I think AI is going to be a great friend to those types of people and to the people who use it. I think, you know, crawling under a rock and sort of trying to fight it and resist it. Obviously, there needs to be regulation. I think that's the obvious things, particularly when it comes to healthcare and these types of things. But I think for kids and for students, this is a benefit done properly. But it's something I really am really worried about because sometimes I think, well, maybe it is helpful to the brain to know your multiplication tables up to your 20s. I mean, maybe there's something going on in your brain that like it just primes you for other types of difficult cognitive tasks. And so I don't know. It seems kind of like a shame to throw that out, but you're right. Like I think cursive writing, multiplication tables, long division, conceptually makes sense, but I don't know. I don't know if anyone has the answer. We're all just trying to survive, brother. You know, we're just trying to figure out the best thing to do.
Yeah, listen, I think mental stimulation is kind of the key. So on my Instagram, it's crazy. My Instagram feed, one of the things I actually follow a lot of, I like SAT math questions. I'm you're like, wait a minute, you're just like an old man.
You too. So I get those feeds too. That's funny. Yeah,
I love the SAT math questions because they're all like. They're all like exponent based and this and
yeah, yeah.
It brings back good memories and like, oh yeah, that's how you do the math. And so I like that because I like the mental stimulation of it.
Yeah.
I promise I won't sit for the SAT anytime soon. I did that 40 years ago. I'm good. But I think the stimulation is kind of the key. And I think, yeah, you're right. Teaching our kids, be more creative. Let your mind wander. What do you think would be interesting to you? That's probably the most important thing.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What are you telling residents now? Because you talked to a number of residents or early surgeons early in their training, or maybe medical students.
Right.
Do you specifically say, do you talk about specialties? Do you talk about, hey, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. So I don't teach residents one-on-one anymore, but I travel a tremendous amount and talk to young ophthalmologists all the time, taking countless selfies with them. I love these guys because they're so enthusiastic. I have only kind of my three takeaways for them are, number one, you've got to learn every single day. You've got to learn something every day. I think that's kind of the key. And it's why I do cataract coaches a video every day. You're going to learn something. Just give me 30 seconds if you see them on Insta, or maybe 3 minutes if you see them on YouTube. I'll teach you something today.
Yeah.
The other thing is you got to, that's rule one. Rule two is you got to embrace new technologies and new techniques. You can't kind of be afraid of that. Yeah. And the part of the new technology, new techniques is going to be robotic things, going to be AI things, et cetera. And the last one is like, yeah, you're the future of ophthalmology. You got to question everything and challenge everything. And so those are kind of my take-home messages. And that's after I give a lecture, which I'm actually doing one early tomorrow morning for McGill. We're doing it remote, 4:30 my time, 7:30 McGill time.
So okay.
But yeah, that's the, I show the robotic stuff. I show some of our AI projects, our lens calc stuff, the patents we got. I'm not that special, to be honest. I'm just super hardworking. And I'm just kind of get really kind of passionate or kind of stuck in my head and pursue things with relentless drive. That's kind of my good skill.
Yeah.
But those are the take-home lessons for the young ophthalmologists. Yeah, it's what you got to do. Teach, learn every day, do something. Well, you say, I don't know anything about AI. Well, today is the day you can start learning.
Yeah.
One thing a day. And then, yeah, embrace new techniques, new technologies. And then, yeah, think differently, challenge yourself, question everything.
What do you tell them about specialization? Now, here, I don't only mean like specialties in terms of ophthalmology, cornea, retina, anterior, blah, blah, blah. I'm also talking about, you have to broaden your mind a little bit outside of even ophthalmology. I mean, because there's so many problems that we deal with, like, you know, all these low hanging fruit, insurance verifications, everything like that. I think that's a big, you know, I don't want to say like ophthalmologists were myopic in that way, no pun intended, but you know, there's a world beyond just that. I mean, there's so many tools that you can use within AI to help with other problems you have. So you have to sometimes like go beyond that. But what do you think about that? And what do you think about like specialties in general, like within ophthalmology? I mean, do you think this is going to impact their selections with regard to that?
Yeah, I think it will for sure. I think probably the most important thing in choosing your specialty is, what do you love?
Yeah.
What can you be excited about? What does not work to you? Like, if you want to sit here and you want to talk about like retina white dot syndromes, to me, that's a lot of work. And I'm not going to be excited about it. I'm just not. But you want to talk about some crazy cataract case and the bad zonulopathy and this traumatic. Oh, yeah. I'm all ears. Let's do it. So finding what you like. The other thing is, you don't have to ultimately choose your final outcome now. You can always change gears in the future. The first probably 6 years of my practice, I did everything that walked with me. I did general ophthalmology.
Yeah.
I did kids. I did basic strabismus surgery. I did lid surgery. I did diabetic PRP laser. I did obviously cataract surgery, glaucoma. I did some cornea. I did whatever I could do. I just did everything. But then I finally, you know, after a while, you know, I actually really enjoy this stuff, this anterior segment surgery. I don't really want to do PRP. In fact, the story there was, I had a patient where I did his cataract surgery. They don't know cataract from glaucoma, from diabetic retinopathy.
Sure.
And they said, it was an easy surgery. But for them, they thought it was laser. Oh, it must have been laser for the cataract. It's like the year 2001, 2003 or something.
Right.
And then he tells his friends, oh, no, you go to him. He does this laser. I see, great. It's the best thing ever. It doesn't hurt at all. Well, it turns out his friend comes in with bad proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So I got to go to town doing some, you know, thousands spots of PRP. And that guy says, oh, my God, it hurt. And I don't, it's the laser. It is. He docs it as a laser. It hurt, and I don't see any better. Like, wait a minute. Maybe I should be referring out all the retina to people who love retina.
That's right. Yeah. That's really funny. My view on the sort of specialty versus generalist is that I have a tendency to believe that AI in the future is going to reward generalists. I don't mean by general ophthalmologists. I just mean generalists in the way you think, because it will reward type connections. And so to have connections between like, even your IOL calcs, like there are thousands of ophthalmologists back then who were doing cataract surgeries and using IOL calcs. Why, you know, how did you come up with that idea? Well, you had a friend and you had this, and you probably had like some weird connection. you thought about AI, you saw Deep Blue, and then you thought, hey, like, there's a connection here. There's a connection from what I do in my domain to connection to something else that's apparently not related, but there's a definite relationship. So that's what I think. I think AI is going to, because you have the expert to just like ask these questions, like, hey, like, imagine ChatGPT existed in 1999. You can be like, hey, like, I just saw Deep Blue. Like, is there a connection to using IOL calc? Can we use AI for IOL calcs? And so I think that's going to, I think generalists in the idea of sort of the way I'm thinking about is well-read, you sort of access to multiple different types of knowledge, you know, you're not just so focused on one particular thing that you're able to sort of draw connections out from a wide disparate view. And so that's sort of where I think about the future. I mean, I don't know if it specifically applies to specialists within ophthalmology, but in terms of innovation, that is really something I'm excited about. So that's what I'm trying to encourage people just to be, read a lot of stuff.
Right. So maybe instead of doing what we did, which was you go to undergraduate, your university, and you're an ultra specialized thing. Like I was microbiology and molecular genetics, yeah, which of course, everything I learned back then is completely outdated and useless.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have been better if I had like a classical education of the humanities, a more of a liberal arts education where it's a lot more thinking and discussing and more of the philosophy and more that. You know, it's funny, maybe actually better for the future. So maybe when your kids go to university, maybe they should, you know, consider going to a really well-rounded education.
You know, I was a philosophy major and I did a lot of political philosophy and ethical philosophy. So yeah, I kind of maybe I'm like preaching my own, you know, to myself here a little bit. But yeah, I think that, and that's part of what we do at our podcast, AI and Eye Care. It tries to connect the three O's of eye care. Because ophthalmology, sometimes we get siloed off. So we connect the optical companies, mm-hmm, optometrists and ophthalmologists. And I know, you know, sometimes we don't see the same things the same way, but you know, we're all in the business of helping people see better and we all need each other.
Right.
And so that's one thing. One of our mandates is we want to publish for everyone, everyone in the whole industry. And so that's been a real, it's been great because we have optometrists and ophthalmologists and people from industry all coming together saying AI is going to be so disruptive that we're all going to need to work together because
I like the team approach.
Yeah. Because there's, you know, the truth is there are other players out there outside of the eye care industry that are coming to potentially eat our lunch. Right. You know, you think about large companies in the Bay Area, like, you know, Meta and Google and their smart glasses. I mean, there's, especially for diagnostic like optometry and eye care, there's a potential in the future that we could be not be that involved in primary eye care in the same way.
Right. Right. Tell us more about your podcast. We'll put a link down below in the description. You can check it out.
Yeah, it's published by Jobson, which is owned by WebMD. It was started by myself and Dr. Scott Morris, who's an optometrist based in Colorado. We only launched a year and a half ago after a conference called Vision Expo West, which is in Vegas. And that's really a conference geared toward the optical industry. But we thought at that time, because I worked very closely with on optometric sort of industry related projects, that we need to incorporate all of eye care, including ophthalmologists and optometrists. And we can't be so siloed anymore.
Sure.
Because in the future, we're going to have, you know, you can imagine going to your CVS or your Walgreens or your Walmart and getting an eye scan and then being referred out and where oculomics and you know, robotic surgery. And we just wanted a platform to educate our stakeholders, those three people, to really educate them on what the basics of AI and eye care are. And so we have a podcast, and one of the great things we do that we have an educational component. The first 5 minutes we talk about, hey, what is AI? What is a transformer? And we're getting pretty sophisticated now. What, you know, what is hallucination in AI models? What does that even mean? And so I've gotten a lot of really great feedback. So I would never have looked this up myself. I'm so glad you guys are talking about that. And so we encourage everyone to please give us a look, AIandEyeCare.com. And looking forward to speaking and to other great, and thank you so much, Uday, for being on our podcast.
For sure.
We're really great, number of really great guests that we're excited about.
Yeah, I think it's going to be transformative. I like your team approach of using kind of basically all the three O's for essentially helping people see better. I mean, that's where it's going to go. And that, I think now we're finally seeing more traction. Google Glasses didn't really work 10 years ago, but now you see Meta with the clever partnership with the Ray-Ban glasses is really kind of picking up steam. I've seen patients on my clinic wearing them. I'm like, hey, whoa, okay, you're wearing these. And they're like, tell me how great it is. And
I
think we're going to get, it's going to be a game changer for sure. But that is encroaching on our field for sure.
It is sort of encroaching on our field, and I think we need to be involved. I think patients are going to come to us and say, hey, doc, like, what about all these VR headsets? I mean, virtual reality, AI, how does it impact my eyesight? What should I be doing? What should I be worried about? And then diagnostics that may be on those glasses themselves, you know, looking at, looking at ocular surface disease, your blink rate, and then also doing oculomics on the surface of the eye. You know, Google also released a paper recently, not looking at the retina, but looking at anterior segment photos and being able to track your glycemic index based off your conjunctival photos.
How?
I'm shrugging for your listeners. Again, the same way, how did it figure out your sex, male or female? It does it. We're not sure. There's a little bit of a black box, but it was able to. They have a paper that they published. And so you can imagine a future where people like just take a selfie of their eye or their face and being able to get all sorts of systemic information.
Wow. Yeah, for sure. I didn't even put two and two together. Yeah, obviously the retina photo, but I didn't even think about the anterior segment photo.
Yeah. And all sorts of other things, looking at lid movement to determine early onset Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I think those are all sorts of things that are coming that it's going to interface really interesting with the ophthalmologists and the optometrists. So when they have these Ray-Bans on, they may get a notification in the future saying, oh, you know, I got a notification. So as eye care providers, we really need to be on top of this and understand how these devices work and also interface with these devices, because it's going to be, what a great world to be able to catch things early and to educate our patients when things, you know, when they have devices that they need some help with. So I'm really excited about it, but I think we should approach it with some caution and help these companies really do it in a patient-centric type of way.
Yeah, for sure. You got me thinking, even just our eye exam now. I mean, look how it's changed over the last 20 years. Now, essentially, every patient is going to get an OCT macula, OCT optic nerve. You know, every one of my pre-op cataract patients gets that. And obviously, majority of the time, we don't bill for it because there's no disease. But you check it anyway. Can I just automate the entire exam? Do I even need to be there? Couldn't I do anterior segment photos? Right? Couldn't I do the posterior segment scans with OCT, whatever else? I could do a wide image retinal fundus photo. I mean, do I need to see the patient in person?
Yeah. At our podcast, we talked about the future of the eye exam and what that's going to look like. And
tell us.
Well, it's kind of, you know, you have a beautiful office there I'm seeing on video. And it's kind of funny that, you know, the last time I saw my primary care doctor, because I did one of these concierge things, I went in, got all my testing done, then I went to his office. And we talked like two normal human beings at an office with a nice desk. There's some books. He asked, you know, I had drinking a cup of water, talking about my health. Why can't we do that? Why can't we elevate the care in ophthalmology? I can imagine a future where they come in, they see myself in the same setting with screens all around, with not just slit lamp photos, but with high fidelity images in potentially in 3D, and there are companies that are working on it, of your slit lamp, of your cornea, anterior segment, retina, all around you. And the IOL callouts, you have your AI IOL callouts with the graphs, and talking to them in a normal way, human to human, with no screen, no slit lamp in the way, and talking to them about their options. I think that is just a higher level of care that AI will enable for the eye exam.
Wow. Yeah, but that's going to sound like a lot of out-of-pocket. You got to better prepare the patients. Now that we enter the era of the sub-$500 cataract.
Maybe, but I'm not sure that's actually the case, because you would line up all the devices in a row. A patient comes in, do all the devices, and they go to your actually makes it easier for the surgeon. They come in to a nice office and they talk to you like a normal human with screens around. I mean, you can just have a nice fireplace going and you'd be talking to them. I just that to me is super exciting because It's kind of crazy. I mean, a Slump is an amazing device, but I wonder, it's weird. You're like, you know, you're like 10 inches away from their mouth, and then you come back and you start just, and they just had a light in them. And if you think about it from just a customer experience, like they can't see, they're like half blinded, they're dilated, and you're talking to them about all these options of cataract. I mean, it's complicated stuff. Isn't there like a better experience? Yeah. But I agree. I mean, costing is a big issue, but.
Well, imagine this. Imagine they come in, do all this automated testing on these fancy machines, front to back, the entire eye, you name it, the works. Then you have the patient interact with an AI agent to explain kind of their needs for their vision, their personality, their tolerance for dysphotopsia. Let's say we don't have an accommodating lens yet. And then, okay, then the AI determines not only what would be probably, given the interaction they had with the patient, what's the best lens option. Maybe the dominant eye should be a monofocal toric lens aimed for emmetropia. The other eye should be a multifocal lens, trifocal, whatever it is. Then it does the AI calcs for you with a precision you can never achieve on your own. Then you go to the surgery, and then you've got the robot assisting you to do the surgery, and you program the robot to be far more precise than a human, far better reaction time. You can even program the robot, hey, don't let me come within 5 microns of posterior capsule no matter what. You have a saber surgery. You put the lens, boom, the whole thing. Look at that.
The whole thing end to end. But here's the beautiful thing about that. The surgeon, the human is still involved. In my mind, there's actually more connection. You may spend actually more face-to-face time with the patient in like high quality time, not just like, yeah, after the sit lab, they get barely, and then you send them off to their surgical coordinator and they don't talk to you again. And after surgery, super busy. And I think this is a higher level. I think patients would prefer that. I mean, I know surgeons would, but I think this is better overall care and more personalized care. So I'm super excited. I love the way you talked about the end-to-end solution. Yeah, I think
you supervised by us. Like, you know, when I flew back from on a plane from, I was in Brazil a few days ago. I had a great pilot on the plane, obviously very talented, but I also had autopilot, and radar and GPS and crazy computer systems with extra redundancy. And I'm glad I didn't have just the human pilot with none of the other technologies. I want it all.
You want it all. You want it all. And it doesn't replace the human. It gives you comfort that there's a human there. And it gives you comfort that there's all these. I don't give the pilot extra credit for flying without those types of other additional tools. I would not. I want you to have that. And as a patient, I want my surgeon to have all those tools. Even if they're the best surgeon ever, I want them to have that those redundancies in there.
Right. If you're, like I said, back to my OCT example, if you're an ophthalmologist like me, who's 50-ish or older,
yeah,
you did your training without an OCT machine.
Yeah.
At all. There was no anti-VEGF, by the way, either, right? Nothing. But aren't you happy now that I have Don Gass's diagnostic ability in this machine in my clinic that scans the eye and tells me, oh, that's the low malar hole. It's grade whatever 3. I'm just so happy that I don't have the natural innate ability to develop a Don Gass brain. He was an exception. He was the top of the top of the top. So this is, I think, going to be the same thing with AI. You're going to have the ability to have these incredible diagnostic, but also therapeutic treatment regimens and protocols that you couldn't really do easily on your own.
Yeah. The key is not thinking AI as artificial intelligence, but thinking it of as augmented intelligence. And that distinction is important, especially to bring everyone on board. Because I know there are many healthcare professionals who view this with so much trepidation, and I get emails from them because I know this, and like, how can you be doing this? Is it going to ruin the patient physician relationship? It's sacred, and you're putting a robot and AI in between. How, you know, I think the examples of airplane safety is a great example, and I think elevating the patient experience and saying this is just another tool to augment our intelligence in a profound ways, because we want to bring everyone on board. This is not meant to, this is like, as we mentioned earlier, this is about democratizing all the tools that we have and bringing, as you say, everyone to like the highest level of potential care.
Right. I don't give my ophthalmologist extra points if he diagnosed my macular thing without an OCT.
OCT, right.
Well, what did you do the OCT? Let's like, don't for sure.
Exactly.
I mean, I get you're really good with the 78 diopter and it's a little amp, but okay. Yeah. Yeah. Or you get the old school Ruby lens or a contact lens. Okay. But you can just OCT it.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think the OCT has replaced us as ophthalmologists. So I don't think augmented intelligence, which I like, that's a good new AI version. I think that's not going to replace us either.
No. So I'm super excited about all the tools we have in the future for augmenting all our abilities. So I look at it, and a part of our podcast and our publication is just sort of spreading that gospel type of thing, and getting everyone on board, because you know we're all going to do this together, and we need eye care relatively is actually a small segment of the overall healthcare, but it's an important one, and we need to all work together to sort of bring the future we want to actually realize that future together. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that's what I tell the other people: embrace new techniques and new technologies. This is a key example.
Yeah, and I think your cataract coach is so good at that. You know, there are like so many different tools and techniques that you talk about that I think for a lot of people, like, maybe do it. Well, I saw Uday do it, or I saw one of his videos hit with a guest surgeon do it. Like, and one thing it taught me is that there's so many different ways to do.
Right.
Like, I didn't even think about like the technique, rotating the lens. Like I love those videos of rotating the lens. And like, I don't do that, but wow, that's doable. And there's a benefit to doing it certain ways. And I just love knowing that there's so much variability that is out there. And I love learning about different tools and techniques that people are using. So thank you for doing that. I think that's
fantastic. For sure. Well, kind of gets back to your point about the creativity. So the spinning of the nucleus, we call it the Rosatelli spin, after my good friend, Dr. Neto Rosatelli, amazing surgeon. But that was born out of necessity. So he's an ultra high volume surgeon. So in an 8-hour day in one operating room, he'll do it like 100 or more phacos.
Wow.
In one room.
Wow.
8 hours. And he's worked for the public health system in Brazil. He does these huge volume of surgery. So he'll do 500 cataracts a week. He'll do 20,000 cataracts in a year. So he does cataract surgery every day, all day. That's it. No pre-op, no post-op. That's what he does, cataract surgery.
Yeah, yeah.
So his method idea was, well, spin the nucleus so many times that I break up the adhesions of the cortex to the bag. So he gets the entire nucleus out with just the phaco probe. There's no need to use an IA probe.
Yeah.
And then he just hydro implants the IOL and he's done. And so it's born out of necessity. But it's, but to your point, it's his creativity, because I would have never thought of that. So you've got to be creative. So now going back to your kids, yeah, you got to encourage the creativity, the thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's a time where the phrase of necessity is the mother of invention or innovation. Right. That's exactly it. And I think the other thing is you have to be on the lookout for problems, like problems that you can, that are, and we're surrounded by problems left and right. Like there's so many just problems, like challenges. And that's an amazing one. He was sort of forced to do it, but like we have different problems, like in our clinics and insurance pre-authorizations. That's like, that's an inefficiency that AI can help with. And so, that is a fantastic story. 100, more than 100 a day. That is 20,000 a year.
Can you imagine?
Send him a robot. Send him one of those robots. I think he'll highly.
Well, in the future, it begs the question, could I sit and supervise four robots? I could watch a screen with four robots operating, say, good, good, good. Pause that robot for a second. Let me see. Okay, we can resume, or let me take over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just you're going to get there. You imagine you're doing a full thickness transplant, okay, cornea transplant. And you say to the robot, okay, put a suture exactly every clock hour, make it exactly this length, make it 80% tissue depth.
Yeah.
It's just like, done. It's like, what?
So how are you going to solve the training problem? Because, I wonder, in a world of robots, we may need more gifted surgeons, because the cases that they're going to get, maybe even more. So how are you going to do that? How are you going to train these surgeons?
Right. So that's what I say. I said, you know what? You better step up your game, because what if the robot's good enough to do all the easy cases?
Right. So that's going to be an issue. I think we're going to have to really think about that as in a society. I mean, this is not just outside of ophthalmology too. Like, what about the tough stuff? Who's going to train in a world that's beyond after, we're done operating? Who's going to do the hard cases?
Right. Well, for sure. And then, you know, but I think we still always need surgical judgment. So yeah, initially the robot will emulate us, but I think we're going to come up with newer techniques where it's just not what we could have done with our own hands.
That's right.
So right now, if you think about when you do a surgery, well, I like to sit temporal for cataract surgery. Okay. I like to make my decision here. Why? Well, that's where my hands are.
Yeah.
So, and why do I make, you know, para and a main decision? Well, I have two hands. What if I had three hands?
But you have three hands, right?
What if you're a retina surgeon and you're operating with you're doing a three-port parenchymal vitrectomy? Uh-huh. And what if you have a light pipe that just follows you? Or let's say your infusion port, you have four ports. You could have an infusion in one, you could have a light pipe in the other, and then you program the robot. Like wherever I move my two instruments, it moves the light automatically.
Follows you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wouldn't that be just much easier for you?
Right. That goes back to your earlier point about coming up with entirely new types of solutions, right? We assume the way we're doing it is sort of like the best way, but it's really just the best way so far. And this is just another innovation. I wonder if this is just, you know, phaco multiplication back in the day was not received in the warmest of ways initially, of course. And there may be an analogy here.
You know, it's, for the young people who may not know, Kelman was really ostracized, criticized. He was like a bad guy, a villain. And yet that's how we do surgery now. They said, what are you doing? We don't need this. Same thing you're saying about AI. IOLs. IOLs were so controversial. Do you know when IOLs first came out, academia across the U.S. was famous for saying, IOLs are ticking time bombs in the eye. You should never put an IOL in the eye. This is the reality truth.
A ticking time bomb.
Academics fought like, no, IOLs should not be legal. You're damaging these eyes. And now you wouldn't even think of doing a surgery without an IOL.
Yeah, it's
not. But that was literally the saying was, ask a senior ophthalmologist who's like 70 plus, what was the ticking time bomb in the eye? And say, oh, IOLs. It was a big controversy. So we've gone through this in ophthalmology so many times. And now the people are, same thing, same fear of change. And now you've got people, there's stuff online about me doing the first robot that's so negative.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's in an ophthalmology subreddit. And the text, when the people are writing it, they're clearly ophthalmologists. Like, seriously, people? And no, I'm not going to reply. Someone forwarded me a link to this Reddit subthread. And I'm like, how I'm the bad guy now because I did the world's first robotic cataract. No, that's not. This is the future, I promise.
Yeah.
This is no different than Kelman doing phaco or the controversy about putting an IOL in the eye. It's no different.
100% agree. And I've received, so and I think it's a far minority. I think most ophthalmologists are super excited about these things. Yeah. They see it. And look, we see it and we feel it too. A long day in the OR, your back is hurting. I mean, like back surgery, you know, you can't play pickleball anymore. I mean, it's really impacting to your life. This will increase your longevity. It will increase your joy and happiness in the OR. I think that's the promise. And so I hope those negative views will become increasingly a minority. I think they already are, especially as they start using those tools and reading about it and learning about it. And I think that's, you know, part of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I think it's an exciting time. And by the way, for the full disclosure, yes, I have financial disclosures with robotic cataract surgery, robotic eye surgery company, Horizon Surgical, also AI in ophthalmology with LensCalc. That's another advanced Euclidean solutions of the company. Though I have disclosures in this specific field.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And likewise on the robotic stuff with Horizon. But you know, there's so many different tools. And I think it's going to become a crowded space. And I think it's good for the industry and good for healthcare and good for ophthalmology. And so, again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Uday. This has been so.
Oh, my pleasure. So much to learn from each other. Now, I'm going to put the links down below for your AI and ophthalmology podcast. And then, again, I'm going to start thinking about it more as augmented intelligence, not artificial. I like that. Thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Uday. I really appreciate it.
Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and where you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, probably 2,800 videos by now and counting. And of course, check out our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com, as well as the Retina Rounds podcast. And we can also include our retina colleagues in our fun discussions. So until next time, I'll catch you later.